my fucking... Whoa, 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 whoa. Jeez, that really is long. Holy, holy God.
I got nothing.
Since I left, so I was sitting at the studio and over Linux Fest Northwest, and as in love as I am with my Western digital TV lives, my boxes that have served me fantastically for 10 years.
You even have one installed in your Suburban.
In the Suburban and in the camper. I am sitting at the studio, and I'll be darned if it isn't just really nice to grab Netflix every once in a while or grab YouTube once in a while or have and the instantaneous response.
So what you're saying is you got the NVIDIA Shield?
Well, so first I started with Kodi, and I was like, can Kodi do all the things I want it to do? Because every time somebody tells me, well, this will do all the things your Western Digital can, turns out it can't. Kodi actually does do everything that the Western Digital does, and then some.
Kodi's
and
great.
The thing is, like, one of the things I didn't like, and everyone else likes, it's like my whole email finasco, is I don't want it to try to identify what movies are and then pull all this information down. I just want to open a folder and see all of the titles that I have named. Part of that is I have quote-unquote movies like The Introduction to Linux, which I shot, and there is no IMDb thing. And half the time it gets it right, or it just ignores it. The other half of the time it comes up with a completely wrong title thing, and then I forget that that's even in there. So Kodi actually lets you specify the type of media it is, and one of the options is none. You can just choose none, and then when you open that particular folder, it just displays all the files that are in there, exactly like my Western Digital does, exactly how I wanted it to do.
Yep.
The only problem I ran into was I was trying it on a Raspberry Pi 3, and the Wi-Fi card is just not that great in the Raspberry Pi 3, and so trying to stream a 60 gig file it was just not happening. So I went to the store. And I was buying a TV for our living room, and I'm in the store, and the guy tells me, he's like, do you need a media player? And I said, no, I don't. I've got one. And he goes, well, we have the NVIDIA Shield on sale. It's on sale for $30 off. And I thought, oh, well, that was a really great experience when I was at JP. So I asked him, I said, well, does that one have IR? And he says, yeah, of course it does. Okay, well, yeah, sure.
Which one did he tell you had IR? I'm sorry, which one?
The regular, the non-pro, the one with the 16 gig flash, the smaller one. So for anyone that doesn't know, one of the biggest problems there is in the studio is you sit down to watch a movie, you sit down, you turn the TV on, you get all comfy, you get the blanket on, okay, we're ready to go. And then...
he does
wait,
too.
Which is the remote?
This is what hold on, there's totally the show
remote. Where's the remote for the soundbar? Wait, no, this is the television.
Yeah, which remote did you miss?
Now I push
you got to have three remotes.
We found it. No, that's the one for the Fire TV that's not even plugged in. Which one is it? I don't want to deal with that. So I have my favorite universal remote ever, the Inset 422. And this is coming from somebody who's a dealer for universal remotes. So I can tell you, I have used $800 universal remotes. I know what a good remote is. And I'm telling you, this $25 universal remote off of Amazon is great. So I take this thing home and I set it up in my living room. Of course, it doesn't have IR. The guy's wrong. And my wife is laughing at me because while I'm in the store, she's like, I thought you told me only the Pro had IR. And I'm like, yeah, that's what NVIDIA and Chris and everyone else on the internet said. But that guy at Best Buy told me it does. And she just kind of looked at me and he's like, so that's why you're wasting $200. And I'm like, yeah, basically. So I take it home, plug it in. Of course, it doesn't have IR. Of course it doesn't. But it's amazing. And I show it to Sarah and she, oh, this is great. We have to get these. Okay,
it's
great.
Fast.
So I'm like, well, now I'm $200 in. Just another $100 to get the Pro. So, and as if everyone in my family didn't know that's where that was going before I came to that conclusion. So you take that one back. We go get the $300 one, plug it in. It works great. Program it with the Inset. Works fantastic. I push one button. The TV comes on. The NVIDIA Shield comes on. Everything works. By the way, the resume from standby is outrageous. Like, it's literally instantaneous. So I go back and I go on Amazon and I'm like, okay, time to get one for every TV in the house and the RV and the everything.
You go, that's what I love about you, man. You go all in. Once you decide this is a good thing, you go just like every TV has to have this now.
Yep. So every TV now has an NVIDIA Shield Pro with the mount that goes underneath it because I don't like seeing wires underneath the TV on every TV in the house. And I also am in the process of learning how to replace the spinning disc with an SSD because one of the things I'm really worried about is I never want to have to replace these for the next like 10 or 15 years, and I'm afraid that hard drive is going to go out. So I want to see if I can get there's apparently it's fairly easy. The biggest problem, and Linux lovers will love this, the biggest problem with the NVIDIA Shield replacing it to an SSD is nobody can quite figure out how to get all of the data from the 500 gig drive onto the 512 SSD. Well, guess what? I have DD. I don't have that problem. So they have all these hackabout solutions on how to transfer this data. And I'm like, I'll just DD the drive. It'll be simple.
You know what I did is I got a Western Digital 1 terabyte bus-powered SSD disk, and I hooked that up over the – it's got two USB 3 ports on it. This is – you know, the NVIDIA Shield TV Pro or regular has that. And I just hooked up a terabyte SSD to my primary one. I set it to never sleep, and I'm taking advantage of the Plex server that's built and maintained by the Plex people on there to share it out, and I can have Cody actually connect to those DLNA shares, DNLA shares. It's really slick.
So
all over the land.
Here's my question. Are you worried about, because the thing is, if you've noticed, the drive spins in that thing constantly, even when it's not accessing data. And that's what has the NVIDIA Shield operating system on it. So I'm kind of afraid that drive is going to die being on all the time. I doubt they put that great of a drive in it.
It depends which one. So on my main one, I do have the drive. But on the second one I bought, I got like the really small built-in storage, which I think is SSD. And then I've attached the disk to it.
16 gig.
Yeah. And then I just...
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Android...
So that's the one that's on all the time.
Yeah. And Android supports extended FAT and NTFS for large files, which is hit and miss sometimes. I just actually had it eat... an NTFS folder recently, which required that I hook it up to a Windows machine, which meant that I had to install a Windows machine just so that way I could do NTFS repair. But I did it, and now everything's fine. And I, you know, just this weekend, because I knew you had done this, so I was thinking about this. I really have to say, the third or fourth best feature about this Shield is that it's also a game console. And NVIDIA is working particularly hard to make certain games work on Android, including all of the standard Android games. But also, they're bringing specific games into Android, and it's really good. And all three kids and me were sitting around the couch last night playing really fun, really unique games using the controller on this NVIDIA Shield. And I thought there for a moment, I'm like, you know, I don't, at this particular time, feel like I need a Nintendo. I don't feel like I need a PlayStation or an Xbox. I've got young kids and myself, which very light gaming needs, and about twice a month we sit around the TV and we play video games on this thing now.
So that's interesting. I have my controller, the original remote for my Shield and the game controller have never left the box on any of them.
Yeah.
I stacked all the boxes up, labeled them so I knew which one. Because the neat thing, if you don't know, or the audience doesn't know, you probably know, the all of those controllers, they're all just basically Wi-Fi direct. So they don't require any – it's you can use one with any machine. You just got to pair it, which is pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah. I would also suggest take a look at some of the emulators for different like classic Nintendo consoles. And then you can start playing like Super Mario and those games on the
GoldenEye.
Shield.
GoldenEye. I would play the heck out of GoldenEye.
And if you look at the control layout, it actually maps really well to those retro consoles. So it's a ton of fun to play retro games too.
Now I got to look this up.
And you can load the ROMs right on the local disk. And then those emulators will browse the Android file system, and wherever you've stashed them, you can just load them automatically or once you define the directory.
It exists.
Yeah, it's good.
Exists. They have an N64 emulator.
Oh, yeah, they have. Oh, yeah, there's a few you can choose from.
Oh, I'm totally doing this when I get home.
Does the Shield have Google Play?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you could also install like all those Sega ports that they've been porting.
I have been.
Maybe. So the Android TV has access to different APKs in the Play Store than the regular ones, so you can't install all of the apps. And one of the biggest ones that they have intentionally blocked. So if you have a Showtime subscription or an HBO, you can't install. Even though the app will work on your smartphone, it will not work on the Shield.
You know what? You want to know?
That's
a player?
Fine because that was all secondary anyway.
I have a workaround that I'm playing with, and I'm not sure it's 100%, but you might try it. If you go to the Play Store on the web, you can choose your Shield as one of the target installation devices.
Oh, and push it.
And then when you go into Kodi. There is a section in Kodi where it can enumerate all of the Android apps on your device, and it will list apps that are not necessarily on the TV's home screen.
So it installs the app, but it doesn't add it to the home screen.
Exactly. So the app is there. It's on the file system. It's installed. It just doesn't create a launcher on the TV interface. But if you go in Kodi or you dig around in the file system, you'll actually see the app installed.
You know, I bet you there's probably like an app that lets you add arbitrary things. Thanks to the home screen as well.
Oh, maybe. You're probably right. I've never looked. You're probably right. It's a full-fledged Android device. It just, they try to limit it to stuff that's designed for the TV.
See, I was thinking of it'd be really cool to get the enhanced Final Fantasy remakes that they put out for Android, play it on the TV.
Here in the studio, I take advantage of the GeForce streaming. Now, I'm not suggesting this for you, Noah, but it is essentially a cloud-hosted GPU render farm. Yeah.
Sorry.
And you have to have a decent connection to take advantage of it. But it streams, like OnLive used to, only it works, full-fledged Windows PC games to your NVIDIA Shield. So it is a way for us Linux purists to play Windows games without having to install Windows. So if you consider the fact that it makes a great coding machine, it is a Plex server and a Plex client, it has one of the best YouTube TV apps, and of course it can run Kodi, and it supports local media, and you can play retro games.
And Windows games.
And you can stream Windows games to it. And so then you start, okay, that's not, $200 isn't a bad price.
No, not at all. And the thing is, so in all honesty, I have launched Netflix, I think, twice, and I launched YouTube once. And actually, I didn't even really launch YouTube. I noticed on my phone I could cast to it. So I did that once. And other than that, the rest of the week, I've never left Kodi. But I bought, at the same time I bought the original Shield, I also got a Fire TV, a Firebox, the Fire TV, the box one, the Fire TV stick, the Roku 3, which I was told could play local media, and one other one. I was kind of trying them all out. And first of all, Roku, I'll never buy a Roku device again.
Really?
They have all of, yeah, here's the thing.
Do you know
Roku,
they're going for an IPO? Like, that's news, like, right now as we record, is it like they're going all in?
Here's a dirty secret about Roku that's not such a dirty secret if you look on the internet. They have like this, they like actively try to fight what they call piracy, what I call local content. So if you have, they're legitimately, I have purchased a lot of these movies. And
that's why they're in ISO format, not a good format.
Oh my, right.
Don't trigger him. He's on a roll.
No, that's true. He's right. Nobody else does that. I'm the only one that cares about the menus and the special features and stuff. So never buying a Roku again. The Fire TV works. In fact, it's really, really easy now to get Kodi on it. It's not in the App Store, but there's an app you can download, and then you can download Kodi, and it works flawlessly, but not even a tenth as responsive as it is on the Shield, and no IR. So yeah. It's a cheap way to get into it, but it's the experience is crap compared. And the smaller Shield is actually faster than the one with the spinning drive. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The Shield is
hands down in a way the best.
You know what? Because of the fact that the smaller Shield is faster, I have you're gonna think I'm crazy, but I'm switching over to using Bluetooth for my automation, and I'm just interfacing with the Shield on Bluetooth.
I don't think you're crazy. I think that there is it limits your options then on like what kind of remotes you're going to be able to buy because they have to support Bluetooth.
But more and more of them support Bluetooth. More and more of them are supporting. It's like it's getting pretty common.
Yeah, they do, but so for example, like one of the things down in our home theater, all of that stuff is made by URC, and one of the things that URC does that I really like is it ties right into the automation controller, so it knows when the motion detector goes off, when the door opens, it automatically starts firing stuff up, turning on the amp, turning on the projector, dropping down the screen, all of that stuff, and there's no way you're going to get one transmitter to simultaneously transmit 35 different Bluetooth commands, but you can do that with IR because you can put individual blasters.
That's a good point. So like I'm working at a totally different scale because I'm working with a TV that supports HDMIC and a soundbar. So I can have when I activate the Shield with a Bluetooth command, it automatically then triggers my TV and my soundbar. And what you're talking about, and I've seen it in your old place, and it was really impressive, is you're talking about you walk into a room at Noah's house and it frickin' transforms into a home theater. Like the lighting changes, audio turns on, inputs change to the right inputs, projectors automatically turn on. Like it is several device functionality is kicking off all at once. Whereas with me, I kick off the Shield and it, because of HDMIC, triggers everything else.
Yeah, so it's just two different ways to accomplish the same thing, really.
So today, Roku has filed for $100 million IPO. They had $399 million, that's U.S. greenbacks, in revenue for 2016, which is up 25% from 2015. But here's the main thing, and they admit this in their IPO. They have to, if they've identified a problem, legally they have to disclose it in an IPO. And here's what they disclosed, that the main thing people use Rokus for is Netflix and YouTube. It's their main apps, and they don't make a dime. And that's their fundamental issue right now. What that leads us to, I don't know.
Well, that's reflected.
Well, here's what it leads us to. Here's what it leads us to is they're eventually going to – there's going to be pressure to try to strike deals with Netflix to start paying them to, you know, to include their app in their thing. I don't know how they go about actually motivating Netflix to do that, but that's eventually what it comes down to, right?
Mm-hmm. That statement is very clearly reflected in what is their relatively tiny IPO compared to most tech companies.
True. That is true. And I wish them the best at Angela's house. It's Roku's on all the TVs. And I got to say, I think they're like Roku 3s or 4s. Whenever Roku introduced the headphone jack on the remote, that's when we went all in at Angela's house. And years into it now, they're serving her well. And she and I were just recently talking about maybe replacing them around December, January. Because
shields everywhere.
the Ethernet. Yeah, maybe. Yeah, really. The Ethernet ports are starting to give out on them for some reason. And so she switched over to Wi-Fi. But streaming really high, like at her house, like stuff's like, you know, full resolution ISOs like Noah's doing. And so streaming that over Wi-Fi is hit and miss. Mm-hmm. It's better now with the Eero system. But she and I are just saying, like, maybe in December, January, she's going to want to go to a wired solution. And I think it's going to be the cheaper shield, the non-pro, the one that's less than 200 with no drive, connected back to right now she has Open Media Vault that has Plex and all these other services running on it, and that'll be her solution.
Yeah, well, because she also isn't Noah. She only is in, like, what, two or three spots?
I will tell you. Yeah, two or three. Yeah.
I'll just throw in there. I have three of my NVIDIA shields are on Wi-Fi, and they can simultaneously stream Bluetooth or Blu-rays, no problem.
A year ago, I got to give you a recommendation. You're going to love this. A year ago, and I may have told you about it, but Chaotic Linux submitted a app pick into Linux Action Show, mm-hmm. and we talked about it. It was Tiny Media Manager. It's all one word, Tiny Media Manager.
Okay.
Dude, this is, for people that like stuff offline, what it does is it has, hands down, the best recognition of file names for like TV shows and movies. And it can match them up with legitimate sources online. It has whatever magic they have done in this otherwise horribly looking, I think, Java app is, and I would not be recommending it if it wasn't literally the best way to do this. It can look at your crazy pirated file names or your stupid custom backup naming conventions you've come up with when you rip them yourselves. And it will say, I think it's either one of these three things. You tell it which one it is. It gets the description. It gets all of the trailer information. It pulls it all down into NFO files that Cody can read, and it pulls it all down into info files and all. And it gets the JPEG artwork, and it names it all properly. It applies artwork and album art, and it gives it a structure. And Cody can read that instantly, no needing to download any information, no mismatching, no wrong identification. You use Tiny Media Manager. And I don't know if you remember this, Noah, but at one point on Linux Action Show, I criticized Kodi recognizing things compared to Plex. And I just got this fucking torrent of negative feedback about, you don't know what you're doing with Kodi. You're a total Kodi noob. But the people that were cool, like Chaotic Linux, were like, hey, try out Tiny Media Manager. Everything you want to put on your NAS for your Kodi box to index, run it through this once. And you define the paths. In Tiny Media Manager, you say, look at this directory, look at this directory. So what I've done is look at these extract folders where I've extracted RAR files and go through this and give it all of the identification information you can before it gets moved onto the NAS. And when it lands on the NAS, Kodi opens up, it looks at the directory, it sees all those files, and it never has to pull a single thing off the internet. There's no transfer on my internet at all. I have all of the artwork. I have all of the information. It's like I know I have the perfect canonical source before I even start my TV.
Yeah, I love it. I I'm not using the info stuff, but maybe I'll give that Tiny Media Manager a shot and see if
it's great.
Identify. I mean, it's still not going to pick up, you know, my stuff, right?
But no, but you can. That's actually what I was going to tell you is you can manually create entries for you. You can add your own artwork, and Kodi will show all of that stuff, and it looks really pro awesome. And legit. Yeah, because it looks like it's a Hollywood production.
You know, having gone through it myself, it's actually kind of frustrating that people gave you a hard time. So 13 hours, there is some movie back in like the 70s, apparently, or 80s or whatever, that is called 13 hours. The 13 hours that I have, though, is the amazing, movie about Hillary Clinton killing, you know, a bunch of people in Benghazi. And that 13 hours, despite
just
being
that bombshell in there, moving on.
than the 70s one or 80s one or whatever. It gets the wrong album art and the wrong thing. And it's funny, like, I was sitting there and we were playing with it, and Sarah goes, oh, I didn't know we had that movie. I'm like, we don't. That's definitely about Benghazi. And she's, well, no, I think I told her. I said it was about Hillary Clinton. And then, she's making fun of me, and she's like, I don't think this looks anything like Hillary Clinton. And, yeah.
maybe it's a Cody Democratic conspiracy.
Yeah, I don't know what it is, but whatever it is, it's off now. So,
so happy with it. I know a lot of people like super dick suck FileBot. Have you used it?
No, I've never used FileBot. Is that a Windows app?
No, I think it's cross platform.
FileBot?
Yeah.
Well, let me tell you about bots, Rikai. Those are the way of the future. Oh yeah, look at all this. Yeah.
Step one, I think it's not Java, so that's already a plus.
Okay. The ultimate tool for renaming your movies, subtitle downloader. Actually, it kind of looks like Tiny Media Manager, only a little bit cleaner. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. This could be another one to go. Is that like a GTK app? Or
I don't
what
know.
Is it?
I'm pretty sure it's cross-platform.
Yeah, it is. It works on GNU/Linux and those other ones that people use. So that's a link in the show notes. Last.ting.com, because we can. Because I haven't given Kyra an answer yet. Because it's retro. Last.ting.com. It's great because you'll get $25 off a device or $25 in service credit at Ting. It's a smarter way to do mobile. The average Ting bill is just $23 per phone per month. Wrap your head around that. If you've been using one of the duopolies here in the States, that could be literally $100 less a month. So it takes a second for it to set. Just think about that. $23 when you add up the minutes and messages and megabytes you typically tend to use on Ting. It averages out to $23 a month for a phone. It works really simple. It's your minutes, your messages, and your megabytes, and then $6 for the line. It's Uncle Sam's cut, whatever you use, and that's it. So it works out to be $20, $23 for us because we're on Wi-Fi all the time for three phones. It's like maybe $40 on a busy month.
I had a huge laugh recently, Chris. I was watching a YouTube video. Verizon ad comes up.
They have a great deal for you there, Beard?
Great deal, Chris. They're only charging a $40 minimum per line now.
Yeah, which, per line. Hold on a second. Let's define that. Because when they say $40, they don't mean that you put your credit card in and it will get charged for $39.99 or $40. What they mean is that the base plan is $40. Then there's a $15 E911 fee,
right.
And then there's a $2.65 number porting recovery fee, and then there's a $7.50 emergency state tax thing. And by the time you're done, it's like a $90 plan.
And lo and behold, you go over your allotted amount. Suddenly, it's probably doubled.
Yeah. And what's great about Ting, too, is you can have GSM or CityBay, whatever works in your area, no contracts, no quote-unquote agreements. And if you just want to bring a device, check their BYOD page. You're probably set. And they have a great control panel, great customer service, and tons of nice devices to pick from if you don't bring one yourself.
Yeah, and if for some reason 1 month you go over your average usage, you just go up to the next bucket.
Yeah, it's really easy, and in the end, I've saved thousands of dollars a year. Last.ting.com. Last week, we sent you home with a little homework to watch War Games, the 1983 production starring Matthew Broderick, who I've been told looks like I did when I was his age. That's weird to watch that. But I don't know if that's true or not. I think that's probably relevant to the rest of the conversation, though. It's a young man that finds himself getting into a back door in a military computer. And so this is going to have some spoilers because we won't talk about it, but we didn't really know what to expect when we announced this, and then we watched it, and it turns out, holy shit, there's so many things relevant with what's going on today in technology. So we're going to talk about some of that. But I don't know. Should we preface this with anything before we go further? I guess we should say Noah didn't have a chance to watch it because, it was sort of a last-minute thing we decided recording last
week. But I've seen it before, though. I've seen it numerous times.
I assume, actually, you're going to play the role of the majority of the audience because of that.
And, of course, also, if you want to still watch along, this is the part where you stop listening.
Yeah, you hit pause. You just hit pause and come back. But War Games is so much fun to watch. Like most 80s videos of this era, like Goonies and whatnot, there's a pacing to them that's a bit slow. They spend a lot of the initial movie building the world, establishing the characters and their situations. If you want to see a great example of this, go back and watch Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I just watched this recently. And you remember the aunt, and you remember all these things about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. But what you don't remember is they spend like a solid 25 minutes just world building. Nothing happens, no shrinkage. And so when you have young kids watching it, like the clock's ticking for them, a 30-minute setup, that's really something.
Well, I miss that kind of movie, though.
I know. It's fun in a way. Now as an adult, I really enjoy it. War Games...
I feel like with modern movies, you don't really get invested because the world is just this backdrop you don't care about.
War Games, they really strike a balance here. It kicks off fast. You're thrust into an immediate situation that's high stakes. And my fiance, Hadia, watched this with me. She was surprised by how quick this 1983 movie moved for a movie that's 34 years old. And the things that they touch on in this movie from a technology standpoint are fascinating. So Matthew Broderick gets access to this military computer via totally legitimate methodologies that actually worked back in the time. So first of all, he does a war dialing scan. He gets the whole block of numbers from the operator of this region of California.
Yeah, area code.
Yeah. He programs that into his old 80s PC, and it just dials through every single number in that block.
While he's off at school.
And it notes the ones where a computer answered, and it discards the ones where a human answered or there was no answer, and it keeps a list. This is legitimately something I did back in the 90s when I was auditing the bank I worked for, is we did war dialing against all of our numbers to make sure no PCs were answering on any of those numbers. This is something you really did back in the day. So I loved seeing that. And then once he discovered the number, he had to get access to a system. And the way he figures out getting access to the system is also brilliant. It involves researching the creator of the software and what he loves and his family and figuring out passwords and usernames he would have used based on that, which is exactly how you would have done it.
Yeah.
It was great.
I think before that happened, they also showed like a simpler example of where he hacked into the school and change grades.
Yep, and he looks at the desk, he pulls out the thing underneath the table.
The secretary's desk.
And sees where they've got all the passwords written down, like, you know, store them under the keyboard.
And they showed good password security, regularly changing the password, but you wrote it down.
Yeah. The only thing with the school hacking that seems a little like Hollywood to me was those grades and all of the teachers' information were never networked like that. It was always the teachers had their grade database on their local computer, and then they would upload it at the end of the season or the semester. It was never networked like that. But the way he got access was totally legit. I really liked that. But so then he gets access to this military system called the Whopper. It's like a war game simulation system that can totally respond to the Russians attacking us because this is really the heat of the Cold War. And he discovers it has a simulation mode.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed him.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
He logs in as the professor when he figures out the professor's dead son's name.
Two. How about global thermonuclear war?
Wouldn't you prefer a good game of chess?
No, I'll bullshit up.
Yeah, so he's like, no, I really want to play this thermonuclear war game. But of course, it turns out that this game isn't actually a game. The computer ends up outputting the simulation information to like the main observation.
Yeah, to be fair, it was a game until like about a week ago when they hooked it up to their main system for some retarded reason.
Yeah, that's interesting. And so you have to have like your typical Hollywood plot device as to why you couldn't just go in there and disconnect this computer.
It would interpret a shutdown as the destruction of NORAD. The computers from the silos would carry out their last instructions they'd lost.
So they come up with this plot device where if you turned off the computer, it would automatically trigger launching the missiles, which once you've done that, you can't just unplug this thing.
You know, honestly, I could kind of see that being something somebody would come up with, though. Like, you know, we put in these commands and we don't want them stopped by some third party where, like, you know, like a spy come in trying to disable your nukes.
Yeah. I know. I'm going to give Noah a chance to chime in because, you know, he didn't watch it. So I don't know if you've ever had this experience, Noah, where...
Where you launch nukes?
No, where you fire something up that's really old, or you watch something like an old TV show and you remember that we've been struggling with like touchscreens since the 80s. Like they have touchscreens in this movie. They use pens.
Oh, yeah.
But if you notice that, like, these problems that we think are so hip today are problems like we've been dealing with for like 30 years.
Yeah, it's actually kind of depressing too, because you start looking at it and saying, this is how long we've been trying to solve this particular thing. It's ridiculous that we're still fighting that today.
Yeah, and so I have to say I had that moment big time with this movie. And this movie is a movie about machine learning. It is a movie about machine learning.
Except that I never could get Joshua to learn the most important lesson.
Joshua is the code name for the computer software that runs on the Whopper.
What's that? Futility? That there's a time when you should just give up?
What kind of a lesson is that?
Did you ever play tic-tac-toe?
Yeah, of course.
But you don't anymore.
No.
Why?
Because it's a boring game. It's always a tie.
Exactly. There's no way to win. The game itself is pointless. But back at the war room, they believe you can win a nuclear war. But there can be acceptable losses.
So there's a message there about that, which is obviously throughout the movie. But it's really about teaching this computer, too. About trying to make this computer understand that there's no way to win.
It hasn't learned. Is there any way to make it play itself?
Yes, number of players, zero.
So just a couple of weeks ago, Beard and I were talking about this Dota 2 competition that happened, where they brought in Elon Musk's open AI, and it just crushed all these professional Dota players. Just, like, embarrassingly bad. In fact, one of the guys quit and said something like, you're harassing me, you're abusing me, stop harassing me. Like,
Stop picking on me.
Yeah, it might have been, because he started getting his ass kicked by this open AI. And the way they trained open AI is right in line with the way they train this system. It is the same methodology. So they type in zero players. Then it gets dramatic. So with zero players, it starts playing tic-tac-toe against itself over and over and over again.
Seven.
This is exactly what the Dota system was doing. It was playing with itself over and over again. And one of the things that the AI researcher said over and over again was that it played lifetimes worth of Dota games in like a day. And it would play at a rate that was so much faster than any human being could do. And that's how it would learn, by failure. But despite that, despite the fact that this thing's designed to simulate games, of course, the whole movie is premised around trying to convince all the bureaucrats.
It's a bluff, John. Call it off.
No, it's not a bluff. It's real.
Hello, General Barringer. Stephen Falcon.
Mr. Falcon, you picked a hell of a day for a visit.
General, what you see on these screens up here is a fantasy, a computer-enhanced hallucination.
So part of the whole movie is based around trying to convince all of these normals that what they're seeing is some computer dream. It's a computer hallucination, an enhanced hallucination, as he puts it, and that the simulation isn't real, which is really shockingly prescient, it feels like, when I watch this. Did you get this when you're watching it? Did you pick any of these tones up?
Not really.
Really? What did you take from it?
I just took it as, because they started the movie with, we need to take humans out of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
And this just felt like
automation.
The natural, this is the counterpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. And automation is a huge point of conversation right now. Yeah. And of course, it ends with a message, like all great 80s movies have to. And that is no nukes, okay?
Strange game. The only winning move is not to play.
So the computer, after playing tic-tac-toe against itself over and over again at speeds humans could never even dream of,
somehow on its own decided to switch to playing the thermonuclear war game over and over again by itself.
And then decided that there's no way to win that game. There's one singular topic I've been waiting to talk about for weeks, because I know that only the brown bear will understand. No offense, Beardsley, but you don't have kids. And I just thought
that
maybe,
you know of.
That's true. I thought I'd pass along a little advice to anybody in the audience that's maybe considering having kids, or especially to those of you who are expecting. By the way, congratulations. Expect to have your dick touched more than you ever thought in your entire life. Nobody tells you this. Nobody tells you that your dick is going to get touched, kicked, hit, leaned on, elbowed, grabbed, nuzzled. Way more than you
kidding.
Thought it would.
My daughter's 1.5.
I understand.
So she's at exactly the right height that when I'm getting out of the shower, and it's fascinating to her. So, yes, I've been there, done that, can confirm.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're at that height for years. And the girls especially, they don't have that part. So, like, if they're like laying on your lap, they think nothing about putting an elbow right there or just running full speed into it. And the thing is, like, everybody gave me advice about, like, how they're going to eat or how to help them sleep or how to bathe them or what happens when they make a mistake. But nobody told me what to do with the excruciating pain of my balls, Chris, constantly getting smashed into.
The answer is simple. Just wear a cup.
Yeah, I don't know about that. Then, you know what? Here's what happened. Let me make a prediction. Here's what happened. If you wear a cup, here's what will happen. It'll be, Dad, what's this hard thing? Can we take this hard thing? Take this off. This is uncomfortable. Yeah. I don't like this.
Yeah. 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 They like the nice, soft, cushy pillow of your balls. And it's the worst thing ever. And I assume that they're going to get to an age where they're going to be aware of private parts and they're going to stop constantly touching my dick. But
you got years to go, Chris.
I'm riding that out. And every time you have a kid, that clock resets. So
yep,
buckle up. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. That's where you go to sign up for a free 7-day trial. Oh yeah, and keep us around this here user program. LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. It's a platform created by Linux enthusiasts that looked at Jupiter Broadcasting and said, boy, that's not how you make money. You don't make money podcasting about Linux. You make money training people about Linux. I talked to Anthony, the founder of Linux Academy, about these. Like, we were Jupiter Broadcasting fans. If you guys hadn't started podcasting, we might have gotten into that. But thankfully, you already did that.
You know, Chris, maybe we should...
it's true.
Maybe we should, like, work out a deal where we train people to podcast about Linux.
Wow. I think that's what we do, actually. And then they go off and create their own shows. I don't know if you've noticed this. Linux Academy...
But we could charge.
LinuxAcademy.com/unplugged. It really is a great tool if you want to learn more about the platform, from all of the really basic stuff all the way up to the stuff that's really going to make you money and boost that resume, like Azure and OpenStack and AWS. And they have a course schedule that'll work with your busy time frame. And if you need to go for the certs, and I understand that rat race, brother, you got to go for it. You go over there at Linux Academy, they've got courses that are created specifically to prepare you and the sisters out there for certifications. They have learning paths if you want to go to a different track in technology. And of course, they have humans, not bots. Humans, real instructors, full-time humans that can help you when you get stuck.
There was a dude in the Discord that I ended up recommending Linux Academy to, because he was like, okay, so I am working at this job. It is killing me. It's full-time. I don't have a lot of time to learn stuff, but I want to try and learn some stuff about different sectors that I might be able to move to.
Jeez, were you in Discord bitching again?
No.
I kid.
But
you're making a good point.
He was like, I'm not sure if I want to do like front end stuff or like server side stuff. Yeah. And I was like, well,
how would you?
I don't want to sound like a shill, but this sounds like literally perfect for Linux Academy, because you can just grab whatever you want and just do it at your own pace.
And they got the lab servers too, so you can try out different stuff. They have the courseware that you pick a distribution and automatically adjust all the references to Debian or Red Hat. Then this virtual servers that you can SSH into, when they spin up, they match that distro that you've chosen. It's a great way to just sort of bang things out, because you get 7 days. You can look at it and say, well, this is going to take me 7 hours. This will take me 12 hours. It's kind of like a video game in a sense. They gamify it and it really works. And you can try it at linuxacademy.com/unplugged. Something kind of sneaky, at least it feels sneaky to me, and obviously maybe it's just my Google bias here, but silently, just a couple of days ago, Google restructured again. Well, actually, Alphabet Inc. did, and they have a new holdings company, and Google is buried way down inside this new legal structure, and it's been reincorporated to an LLC. Google, the number one search engine in the world that tracks all of us, is now an LLC, which means there's a totally different level of disclosures, a totally different level of liability. An LLC stands for a limited liability corporation. It will have its own debt. It will be responsible for its own payments, so that also won't be disclosed as part of the Alphabet Umbrella Corporation anymore. and there's certain revenue disclosures they won't have to make anymore, amongst other things, I'm sure. I'm sure that's just the tip of the iceberg.
I believe they don't have to make any disclosures to any investors anymore.
Yeah. And
which I think is the main reason they're doing it.
There's other things, too. There's certain private. There's just all kinds of things. This is huge. This is huge ramifications. You think I'm overreacting about Google being an LLC, Noah? I mean, tell me, please.
No,
tell
not
me
at all. No, not at all. In fact, geez. if you think about it, really what it amounts to is that it's loopholes, because what they've done.
That's
is
what it
they
feels
have
like. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because what they've done is they've taken an entity which people originally invested in, and then that entity got sold to a new entity that got spun up. And now they're going to break a smaller part of the original entity, the one that everyone cares about, the one that everyone invested in, the one that everyone wanted that transparency for, and move it back into a, you know. So, yeah, I do think it's a loophole. That's what it is.
This comes on the heels of a story about Google pressuring a journalist to take down a critical story. And the article, according to this Google internal memo, said the article was problematic and had to come down. So they have like a leak that really pins it to Google. And it stems all back to a think tank that Google is partially funded, that think tank then goes after this journalist. And so Google has like this ancillary insulation layer where they can say, well, we didn't specifically order this to happen. It was an action taken by the people in the think tank. But the reality is that the people get their bills paid by Google, and they came up with a paper that was pretty critical on Google. And when that started to get picked up, Google came down like a hammer. And there's just no way around those facts. Over the last week, I was telegramming back and forth with Noah about this Wi-Fi situation. I mentioned it a little bit. I was sort of evasive about it in last week's episode. And quick recap, in the RV, where I'm parked at right now, I have a couple of different MiFis. The primary one is an AT&T MiFi. That's on one of these old grandfathered, I think it might have been like an iPhone or an iPad contract. I don't really know. I bought it off eBay. So I don't know the origins. But it was one of these unlimited data plans. Oh man, it was beautiful, you guys. It was so great. It was glorious. I would, on average, use about 400 to 500 gigs a month. It was just so wonderful. And it was wherever, if I could park somewhere that had strong signal, I could get 20, 30 megabits. Unlimited. And then about 6 months ago, as I've talked about on this show, AT&T decided to turn on a throttle after 22 gigs. And the great thing is the throttle changes all the time. You never know if it's the reason why things aren't working right, because the throttle is dependent on the throttle turns on, almost cramps it down to dial-up speed when the network's busy. So you never know, is it the throttle? Is it something else? Does it need to be rebooted? Is there a network issue?
You would think in like 2017 they'd have some kind of balancing hardware so everybody gets a decent speed.
You'd think. And so since then, I decided to take surveys of the neighborhood where I'm often parked at now and see if I could find public Wi-Fi. But there was nothing. So for months, I just used this. Basically, after about 2 p.m. Pacific until about 11 p.m. Pacific, it was like being on a 56K modem. You couldn't even load web pages. You can't load modern web pages. It's just so if something urgent came up for work or for family, I would turn my Wi-Fi off on my phone. I still do this actually, and I just use the LTE network on my phone. So I was looking for public Wi-Fi. Didn't really find anything, and it was really okay. So this is just how it's going to be. I adjusted my schedule. I started coming into the studio earlier and staying later, so that way I could get things that required the internet to do my job, which is everything, done. And that was just the way I did things. I just started coming in earlier and earlier and staying later and later. You know, just what you had to do. And then when I go home, I just basically didn't have the internet unless it was just something small. Like I could send some telegrams. But even, you know, if somebody sent me a video or a picture, I couldn't view that. Yeah, and yeah, or you, like, you know, with Usier, like there was an episode where you needed me to review something and I had to wait 2 days until I could make it back to the studio to review it.
Yep.
It was ridiculous, and it delayed the release of this show. And so I talked about it last week. I was elated when I discovered that a business near me had fired up a public access point, and it was filtered. Doesn't let you use Telegram, doesn't doesn't let me hit, I've learned now, doesn't let me hit a few Linux distro repos. It's pretty heavily filtered. But it was a 12 megabit connection. I mean, just a game changer for me. Game changer. From 56K to 12 megabits, holy crap. So I started looking into different Wi-Fi boosting options, because what I learned is I could receive the Wi-Fi signal, but I couldn't transmit back. I didn't have anything strong enough to go back to the AP. I could receive almost all of the signals, but I needed something that was really capable of getting back to the AP, and nothing I had could do it. I needed something on top of the RV, on top of Lady Jupes. And I looked into different products, and I found the Wi-Fi Ranger, which caters towards RVs. And they have the Sky Pro Pack. It has an 802.11n and a 2.4 antenna on it, and it comes down via Ethernet to a Mikrotek Linux router. Or does Mikrotek, is it router OS? It's router OS.
Yes.
Isn't it?
No, it's Linux. It's a Linux operating system that they wrote called router OS.
Okay. And so it comes down to a Mikrotek machine where this runs a themed custom like UI on top of the Mikrotek interface, and it specializes in like scanning Wi-Fi and connecting to Wi-Fi networks. And it's not cheap. It's obviously this is a necessary business expense. Plus, it gets installed to the roof of the RV, and every place I go with the RV, I take advantage of this. And when they said on the documentation that it got 1.5 miles of range,
understated.
I thought that was cute. I thought, okay, well, so I need about a half a mile, so I'll get the 1.5 mile, because they do offer a smaller one, but it's a significant downgrade in several ways, including the transmit power, which is what I needed up to FCC regulations. I needed right up to that line, which their Sky Pro Pack for Wi-Fi Ranger at wifiranger.com does. It goes up to, I'm talking on my ass, but it's something like 1,000 milliamps or whatever, which is the, and it does like 999 milliamp, which is the, yeah, it's right up, whatever it is.
Before you get to buy some kind of license.
Exactly. It's pretty much, I really am talking on my ass. Oh, here it is right here. Here it is actually right here. So the max radio transmit power is 1,000 milliwatts. It auto adjusts depending on what it needs to do, but it can go up to 1,000, which is the FCC regulation.
Yeah. Cool. After that point, you become a broadcaster.
Yeah. And which I was like, okay, so I'm going to get this. And I ordered it. I had a really great technical conversation with one of the guys over there named Evan. He's on there. He's like in there, like he's like their brand strategy guy or something. And he answered all of my technical questions, including I asked him the differences between DBMs and DBIs and transmit powers and receive powers. And I asked him about tunneling VPNs, and just really was able to have a very frank technical conversation with the guy, which that alone, it was eight email exchanges, which he answered all of them on a Friday in the afternoon. Really sort of was like, okay, these guys got their shit together. Plus, I respected the fact they're using Mikrotek to do some of the hard work here, because what they do is they can combine multiple frickin' internet sources from over a mile away and local ones, and they can balance across all of it using this Mikrotek. I'm going to get there in a second, but let me tell you what I discovered when I installed this thing. So I crawl up on my roof, and I put this thing on the roof, and I throw the Ethernet cable down the side of the rig, and I run it into the rig, and I connect it into this Mikrotek router, and I fire it up, and son of a gun, if it doesn't discover 75 Wi-Fi APs around me. 75! And guess what? Some of them are open that I could, I had this one AP in mind that I had discovered by walking around scanning for Wi-Fi access points.
I see where this is going, Chris. You're going to use multiple connections, aren't you?
So guess what? One of these, which is over a mile away, a Wi-Fi connection.
Is it gigabit, Chris?
It's 2.4 gigahertz. 2.4 gigahertz, 802.11g. From a mile away, over a mile away, I've connected to, and it is a local county ISP called Pogo Zone. You should look them up if you're in the Skagit or Bellingham area. And they are a legitimate, well-reviewed, well-liked, traditional local ISP that is using the hills around our community to beam what they call Ethernet. I don't know why it's called Ethernet, because it's like a wireless microwave, but the latency is lower than what you can get on Comcast.
Yeah.
to give people essentially what they call Ethernet service. And the end product is they install a box and they install a dish and they give you an Ethernet cable. And they're super well liked by people in the know in our area. And they've set up a free Wi-Fi access point in downtown Mount Vernon, which is connectable by this Wi-Fi ranger. And it's not perfect because it's so far away. I drop about 4 to 5% of my packets, which is just enough to be a pain in my arse. But because I can combine it with other Wi-Fi radios, I'm using that to connect to my MiFi, and I'm able to use the load balancing features of the MikroTech or MikroTech to balance my connection. So when one connection's busy or has a high latency, it automatically uses the other one. And if one's like if we're using one to stream YouTube and we want to load a web page, it'll use the other connection. And the MikroTech itself that this Wi-Fi ranger comes into is also now acting as the Ethernet bridge to my Eero wireless. So I go from my Eero Wi-Fi access point into the MikroTech, and the MikroTech uses its smarts to pick the best connection around me, be it my MiFi or other open public APs, and it does all of the logic there and just gives a solid Ethernet connection to my Eero. So my LAN is never the wiser. The devices have no idea. Their IPs never change. They just work. It's so great because I got to be honest with you guys. I really fucking needed a win. Like I have lost on so many fronts recently, financially and water and all of these things. Like and then to be somebody who makes their living on the internet and be on dial up. It was so excruciating. Like a host had sent me something. And they're like, "This is urgent. You need to see this." And it took me minutes to load this. Like it was excruciating. And to now put this thing in and have free internet that is dynamically load balanced between multiple connections, I didn't realize how badly I needed this win until I got it.
It gets even better because this goes back to my. I saw a really interesting article from Canonical, actually, that was talking about how to win at IoT, and the rest of the article is kind of irrelevant to this conversation, but the one thing that they said, their top advice was make sure that you're picking strategies, not products, and that kind of applies here, right? So the advantage of Wi-Fi Ranger using a standardized router platform is not only is it going to get you amazing internet into your RV, but the other thing you can do if you ever choose to do so is because RouterOS is undoubtedly sitting underneath their special mm-hmm. UI, you could just SSH into the thing and just set up a VPN from your router into the studio, and all of a sudden you'd have a direct connection to all your file servers and all that stuff.
I've already turned on SSH and I've logged into it, so I'm pretty sure I could do that. And the other thing that's super great about it is if at any point I'm parked somewhere where I could have an Ethernet cable as my internet source, I can plug that into the MikroTech. And everything just switches over to that. It always will switch over to wherever the fastest connection is.
You sent me a picture, and I think it was the HAP, but does that have a USB port on the side?
Yep, and so I have the MiFi plugged into that, and it's aware
you
that
do.
It's a...
Okay.
Yep.
You know, it kind of makes me think that we should, get another one of these and figure out how to attach it to,
I know, right?
to the studio.
Well, that's what's so great about
that
it.
That way when Comcast goes down, we're not super screwed.
Yeah, you could have a Ting MiFi plugged into that thing that does your data backup for the 2 hours that you're
ISP's
down.
No, dude. No, you leech off somebody else in the neighborhood, man. You don't have to pay for Ting MiFi.
Yeah. you put that thing on the roof, you could probably pick up a lot of access points here in Smoky Point.
I feel like you'd top 1,000 here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so great because this thing's installed on the roof. So wherever I go, I can do a scan. And when they said a mile and a half, I thought it would be less than a mile. Like, I think it's over a mile and a half.
Yeah, it's like when they say a mile and a half, what they mean is like in a vacuum tube with laser-aligned antennas, that kind of thing.
That's what I thought. But, dude, I'm telling you, the AP it's picking up is well over a mile away from the RV. And I'm using it as my primary internet source. And by the way, these guys, this PogoZone Linux, or PogoZone, these PogoZone ISP guys, they're probably going to get my business because after I got on their AP, I looked them up. And then I got on a call with one of their support people. And sure enough, if he can't install a dish on the barn and then just run an Ethernet cable to the RV. And their prices.
Dude, I would totally do that.
Yeah,
jeez,
well,
I would
think
that
about
in a heartbeat, dude.
And even for their best connection, their best connection, $50 a month. $50.
Yeah, that sounds like Midco.
That is so unbelievably low price, because here at the studio we're paying nearly $300 a month for a semi-equivalent connection.
Sounds like.
And
the,
here's the other thing too: your super pro business connection from Comcast doesn't even have static IP. I couldn't believe that when they told me that.
Well, and these guys are great, because you can just ask them all kinds of questions. Like, I was describing to him the setup and the rig and how I would run the cable, and he's like, "Oh yeah, that would totally work."
It sounds like you're finally making the barn home base, Chris.
Maybe I actually think that's probably
yeah. Not only I don't know if you've seen. Well, you're not on Facebook, so maybe you haven't. But not only is he making it home base, he's turning it into a tourist attraction.
Yeah. Do you? What did you hear? What did you see? Because that's actually.
Well, I've just.
You're talking about my mom?
Yeah. And all the people that are asking, like, where do you sign up? How do you get tours?
So,
where can you go?
I don't. So I published a vlog, and here's the funny thing.
You know why this happened, Chris?
What?
Because you said there was secret stuff.
I guess.
That you couldn't show.
Well, that's true. There is.
Skimmed your camera over it.
So, so a couple of people, including my mom and neighbors, have asked for tours. And my first reaction is, well, why do you need a tour? I put it all in the vlog. That's my first reaction. Like, what do you don't, you know?
But
like,
it's not the same as being there, Chris.
Yeah,
it's an experience.
Not. It is. It really is. And what I've discovered is it's a different experience depending on the time of day. So if you go when it's dark, it's a much creepier experience than if you go like when the sunlight's coming in through the windows, which other people have gotten tours. We timed it a little bit better, so it's a little less creepier. Yeah, it has become a thing. And here's the other thing is I this is a safe space because there's no way in hell the people that own the barn listen to this show, but I haven't gotten permission. Like, the thing is that people are just really insistent. Like, they all want in the barn now. They really want all. And Hadi and I, each time we're like, what? And so the neighbor comes over and he gets his kid. Oh, I shouldn't say this. I shouldn't, because I like this guy. I shouldn't say this. But the whole thing was just fair, because he might listen. The whole thing was like, we were like, no, we're not giving any more tours. That's the rule. And then the neighbor turns out the neighbor's standing outside our door and wants a tour. And we're like, well, and we want to make nice because we really like them. And so we don't want to be like rude about it. And so we ended up giving tours, and then he recorded it on his phone, and then he posted that on Facebook, which then made more people want tours. And
I feel like you need to talk to the people that own the barn and get some kind of like rev share going on.
I do. Well, there. I don't think they want.
There are legitimately people on Facebook asking if it's open to the public, how much tours are, whatever, how much they cost to get it. I totally turn that into a tourist attraction.
It's so funny. I'll put a link in the show notes to the episode of the vlog, because it's really the best stuff's in the vlog.
I feel like you need to just buy a plot of land with like a broken down barn as a decoy place to send people.
Dude, that's not a bad idea. It has crossed my mind. Of course you have to watch vlog 52 to know what I'm talking about, but it's crossed my mind to say, you know, when we get some money coming in, let's make an offer to refurbish this thing, because we looked at it and we think $5,000-$6,000 could get that place turned around into a place that I could use as a home office. The kids could use it as a living room. It's got a kitchen, which would be really nice.
I feel like $4,000 will be removing that ancient dishwasher.
I will defer to you because you've actually been there and I haven't, but I'm highly skeptical of that figure.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm just talking
about. I'm thinking closer to 20.
Oh, geez, you think? You think?
Yeah. Well, just getting the outside alone so that there aren't holes inside of the siding and stuff like that, and getting some insulation up so that the place doesn't freeze.
So to be clear, the primary residence would still be Lady Choops, but that would be like a family center to go to, which would have a kitchen and like a TV up there and like some rooms for me to work out of. But it wouldn't be like we wouldn't live up there. We wouldn't occupy.
So what you're saying is when you say refurbish, you just mean like make it so that you can walk in there and use it.
Clean it up, redo the stairway up to it, because there is a stairway up to this residential area. So there's this barn that I park next to for people who don't want to watch the vlog. There's a barn I park next to, and it is a huge barn, and I've grown up around barns, so I have perspective on the size of barns. It's hard for me to illustrate in video, but it is, you could probably park 8 school buses in this barn. I mean, it's a large barn, and it's got an area that has a bunch of equipment and extra supplies related to construction of homes, hotels, and businesses. So materials that are valuable. And then on the second floor of this huge barn, there are two areas. And one area has a bunch of secret stuff that I don't even have all the details on. I can't get into. And it leads to a third area that has even more stuff that I've never seen. But on the second level, in like the 60s, they refurbished it and turned it into a full-fledged apartment with a large two-sink kitchen, a dishwasher, I mean, stuff that was competitive for the 60s, and a nice oven and built-in heaters that use ceramic to heat up, and they just give off this really nice warm heat. I haven't turned them on, but I'm familiar with them. And they refurbished a bathroom with a shower and a bathtub, and it's been untouched for at least people lived in there on and off since 2013. And nobody, from what I can tell, snooping around in the drawers and looking at papers that are there, nobody's been in this space since 2013, until a week ago when my fiance and I entered this room. And it's tile floored. It's got like, you know, 70s, 60s wood paneling everywhere. It's got a kid's room and an adult's room. And it's been lived in. It's very lived in, but it's fixable. Like, it's still got all of the essentials. Like, I think all of the appliances actually work still, surprisingly, amazingly. It has power. The water is turned off, and the stairway to it is rotted away. So you have to come through the barn. But there is actually outside access that's right next to where we parked the rig. And so I started thinking, like, if I had $5,000, $6,000 to invest in this space, I could turn it into like a family center area and like set up one of the rooms as a recording studio, because it's, yeah, I know that's always where I go. I know.
Step one, unnail the door shut.
Yeah. Or get the other, there's actually another entrance that's even more convenient, but it was so weird. It was so weird to go in there, and you can't really capture it very well, but it's like you go back in time. You, not only are you going back to 2013, but you're really going back to the 60s, because everything in there, from the bathrooms to all of the kitchen appliances, is from the 60s.
That dishwasher just really caught my eye. I was half expecting to see like a crank on the side of it.
I know, right? Yeah. Yeah, it was really something.
Who would even think of a top-loading dishwasher?
I know. And you look in there, you can see how it worked, and you had to open it up for it to air dry. But yep. I don't know. You know, it's surprising, because I've been parked there for eight months, I think. And yeah. I suspected it was there because I saw residential windows up there. But it's a huge barn. There's a whole another floor I can't even get access to. And if you look at my vlogs, there's a chimney. On if you look in vlog 52, there's a chimney. That chimney is where the residential area is at. And there is way more barn after that. And I would love to know what is up there. And I'm sure it's rodents and spiders, but there's probably other interesting things up there, too.
Yeah, that's probably where all the rats that are invading are coming from.
Yeah. Oh. Couple of last minute ask errors coming into the show. Hashtag ask error, because people want to win the shirt, which we'll announce the winner of next week. What becomes more fucked up the longer you think about it? And since Noah is our returning champion, I toss it to you first, Brown Bear.
I'm going to go ahead and argue, or I would go ahead and say something along the lines of religion and Christianity. And I don't mean that as a pejorative. I just mean in a confusing, more big, the more I search for answers, the more questions I come up with.
Hmm. And you've been religious your entire life. You are religious.
I have. I am.
So I totally know what you mean, because it's like, is there something that needs to be adjusted for now our better understanding of how the universe works? Like, those kind of questions come up, and the more you dig into it. Yeah. What about you, Beardsley?
Our entire reality, like the way our society is constructed.
So this is where I was going to go. This is a heavy one. Yeah.
Like, there's so much that happens in our world that just doesn't make sense anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. The more I think about it, so we spend so much time working, and we spend so much time focusing on things that are really outside our control. I feel like I'm going to look back at this when I'm in my 70s, and I'm already really worried about this. I'm worried I wasted my time. Like, I have been going through this really deep thought process about this trip to New York that I'm thinking about taking. Canonical has announced their Ubuntu rally, and pretty much all of the folks at Canonical, including Shuttleworth, are going to be there. Solus developer Ikey is going to be there. Folks from Microsoft and folks from all over the community are going to be there. It's going to be like a huge event. And I really feel like I should probably be there. And I want to be there. But, you know, here I am. I live in this 40-foot, 37-foot RV. And the only way I can think about making this possible is if I load up a cooler in my truck and I just drive as hard as I can drive in my truck, because that's just where I'm at right now. And it's, I feel like I've stopped taking risks that I used to take. Like there's a version of me out there that would have just been like, well, fuck it, I'll figure it out. Like, you know, I'll get on the road and I'm just gonna start heading that way and I'll just make it work. Like that road trip to Noah's was a lot like that. And I didn't, you know, before I decided to go on that road trip, I didn't have a truck. I didn't have a trailer. I had a truck, but I wasn't capable. And that didn't stop me. And now I've got the rig. I've got the means, you know, road wise. I don't have the means financially, but, and it's like, what is it? It's like, and I'm like, well, I don't have the money. I can't do it. You know, the more practical thing to do would be either to fly or drive, depending on how it works. And I really kind of look back and I go, shit, I'm going to look back at this and really kind of be a little disappointed in myself about how I'm kind of pulling all this off.
Yeah, there's the lesson of there's always going to be something to stop you, but are you going to be the person that lets that stop you?
So I'll take the other side of this then. Then the other side of that is you also have a responsibility to your business and a responsibility to your kids and your family to make, you know, responsible decisions. And so then you start looking at it and you're like, okay, yeah, I could jump in the truck and I can make that thing, or I just, you know, drive in there, or, you know, fly or whatever. But then I get back and at the end of the day, I got to be able to buy groceries and keep the lights on and put gas in the car and stuff like that. And so there is a balance in there somewhere. And I'm not claiming I know where it is, but there is a balance. And what was the first thing I said when you brought that up to me? So I was like, geez, dude, New York is expensive. I've been to conferences all over the country, West Coast, Las Vegas, in New York City, more times than I care to count. And by far and away, the most expensive things I've ever done have been in New York. You're looking at $1,000, $2,000 minimum to attend a conference in New York. And that's not travel costs. That's just while you're in the city paying for hotels. Food is expensive. Everything is expensive. Transportation is expensive. It just sucks.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like there's always a way to do something that you really want to do. Like, I didn't think I'd be heading to a convention in October back in May, and I'm heading to California in October.
No, you're right. There is always a way to do it. It comes at the thing of trade-off. For, you know, that one event that you attend here is four other ones that you can't attend because of the tremendous cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the perspective that I'm beating myself up with is not so much like I have responsibilities, and it's the when I'm 75, when I'm 80 years old, and
I'm going to regret not
my
doing
health
all this
is
stuff.
Failing me, because I have to assume, like, if I took off. Like, I would imagine, well, maybe I'm wrong, but if I took off and had to make it over to New York in like a 2 week, if I had 2 weeks to make it to New York with the RV where I would stop and do meetups and do shows on the road, it would be a $5,000 trip, I think. And so I don't know, but it could be more than that even. And I just, that's just, I can't do it. I just, even though like I've been moving towards this goal for how many years now? How many years have I been talking about this? How many years?
Yeah, even before
Five?
You got the RV, even you. Yeah. No, longer than that, man. You were mentioning that back in the last days before I was even a host.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, and now I have all the pieces, but I still can't pull it off. And it's hard for me because I look at it and I go, I'm really going to be like, how am I going to view this? Like, looking back, like, way to blow an opportunity. And the thing is like, I have all these crazy ideas. Like, I could go down to Texas and do an episode of Unfilter and talk about the situation in Houston and really be there. And then I would go up to New York and cover this. And then I would come back and see family that's just recently moved to Arizona. And I could take my own food and I'd have all my podcasting gear with me. But the gas, you know, the gas alone. And then, God forbid, anything happened equipment-wise on the RV. And the thing is the RV is a 2014. So it's, you know, we're due next time we take a major long haul, probably for something to break down. And I'm not in a position to accommodate that either.
See, like, I feel like I've gone completely in the other direction where I used to be super, super conservative about stuff. But then I just, at some point, I got sick of, I'm regretting not doing all these things later on. And I've taken more of the tack of, I decided I'm going to do this thing. I am taking responsibility for that fact. Now I have to find a way to make this work.
Yeah, that sort of pressure almost makes you make it happen.
Yeah. You don't see a way to make it work, but you decide to do it, and then you
have faith in yourself that once you're in that position, you're going to find a way to make it work.
You'll find things you didn't think about to make it happen.
So when we went down to North Carolina, I thought, originally it seemed like it was the sensible thing to do to drive, take the RV and go down. And like Chris was talking about, you do run into some mechanical failures, and I ran into more than my fair share on the way down there. And what that taught me was I should have just flown. And the thing is, by the time I got done, when you got done and added all the money up from the extra amount of time that I had to spend on the road to actually get down there, the incredible cost that we incurred, on vehicle repairs and stuff like that and towing and all that other stuff, by the time I got done with all of that, it would have actually been cheaper to fly. And because I kind of threw caution to the wind and just said, we're just going to go. It had some significant impacts on some of the things we were going to do at the house this summer that we just couldn't afford to do then because the money didn't work out. So I can see both sides of it. There's definitely something to just saying, let's just go and we'll figure it out. But the other side of that is you wind up against brick walls later on with things that you can't do because you did those things.
You're more chained down in some circumstances. That's what I'm probably getting. I'm more familiar with that problem now. For me, there's this, going back to the core question, hashtag ask air, what becomes more fucked up the longer you think about it? For me, I've had this creepy sort of persistent, I guess you could call it a biological clock. I've had this urgency since, one of my earliest memories is like 5 years old thinking about this. Like, I really have always felt I've got a really limited time to pull off whatever I'm going to pull off. And then leave my family in a position where they're going to be okay. And I don't know why, but in the back of my mind, it's always been around my 60s. And for a very, very, very long time now. And now that I'm halfway through my 30s, I'm like, gosh, I hope it's not my 60s. Now I'm hoping it's my 70s or my 80s. And I keep telling myself the 40s are the new 30s. But so I'm hard on myself because this clock has only gotten louder the longer I've gone along. And it's not like I didn't know about it. So I get on this position like, you knew you needed to be ramping this up. And you know that this is what you want to be doing. And you're still not there yet. And you've only got so long before this is no longer your primary concern. There's going to come a point in my life where the teeth rotting in my head or the cancer thing on my nose or something with my health is way more important than me getting to New York for a canonical event. And that is just the reality of getting older. And I am in a privileged position right now where I can drive for hours, I can produce content, I have energy, I have drive, and my health isn't failing me at this point. But things are starting to show me that there could be issues. I'm starting to have some issues that remind me that this isn't going to last forever. And so what becomes more fucked up the more I think about it is I can feel things are changing in my health. I can feel that my energy, my ability to stay up. Like before I hired you, I would work two jobs. Then I would come home and I would podcast and then I would edit till 2 a.m. I would set the stuff to encode and upload and then I would go to bed and I would get up at 6:30 a.m. and I would work two jobs and I would podcast again. And there was obviously a check I was writing there against my health, but in my 20s, I could easily do more than I can do now in my 30s, my mid 30s. And it's part of that is some of the choices I made health wise earlier, which I'm now working to correct. But part of it is just the aging process. And so I'm up against this, you stupid son of a bitch. You knew this was a problem all along. You've known this since you're 5 years old. You're now 35 years old and you still don't have this fucking where you want it to be at. What the hell is your problem? You should be doing better than this. And I don't have an answer for that. And it's always this thing. So when it comes to, hey, can you get to New York? When I get this message that says, don't tell anybody, but can you come to New York soon? Because we would like to have you here. And you need to be here at the end of the month. I all of these things that I've built up in my head about all of this, just really just like I have to deal with all of it. Like, Like, I just have to go through these series of compromises and beating up on myself to come to something that is what feels like ultimately a fucking compromise. Well, all right, if I can't take my rig, which I own, to be able to go on the road and produce shows and meet up with people, which I find to be the best thing about my job, and God damn, if there's not an RV park 45 minutes from the hotel in peak traffic. I looked during 5 p.m. rush hour in downtown New York, and there is an RV, I don't know if they have availability, I didn't check, but there's an RV park 45 minutes from the hotel where we could park there. Hadia could go out and enjoy New York while I go to the event. I could come back and edit and produce content in the RV, and I can't close the deal. It's so frustrating. And all these psychological things I've built up around it just beat me up about it.
I feel like right now Noah and I are like the devil and angel on your shoulder, giving you the two opposite opinions.
I'm leaning more towards Noah's direction just because I don't want to be tied down for future decisions.
But at the same time,
the first words out of my mouth when he brought this up is, or maybe the first words was, that's really expensive. But the second words out of my mouth were, hey, listen, I'm always up for a Linux event. But here's the problem. The problem is you have to look at it like this. If you had $5,000 sitting in your bank account, would you take the trip? Or would you start looking at around the studio and going, this is all the stuff I could buy for $5,000 and the way that I could change the network, not just for one event, but for the next 5 years of the way that we do this particular show or that. And when you start looking in that realm, then all of a sudden it's like, man, that's a lot of money to spend.
I'll tell you something that I've learned double this year. And it started to hit me last year, but I really internalized it this year is there is almost an invaluable price on the level of networking that you have at these kind of events. And,
for sure.
You know, there is, I got to say, like a lot of the commentary on Linux Action News, this show and User Air is informed by private conversations that I have with a lot of different various individuals that really give me an insight that I wouldn't otherwise have. And that has an impact across multiple shows that I do. And so even if I went there and didn't walk back with a single bit of footage, I feel like that level of networking and insight that I get, which then informs so much of my commentary, kind of gives me a leg up over other Linux podcasters.
Not to mention the content you'd be creating along the way there and back.
Yeah, that's the other thing is if I could take the rig or even the truck, I would vlog the entire process, you know, the lead up there, and if we could do meetups and all that. So that's also another consideration because that is valuable to me personally, creatively.
Well, not only that, but invaluable in-person feedback from audience members is also super invaluable.
Oh, man.
Because that's completely different than comments on the internet.
I didn't really expect to go anywhere. So it's funny that when this came up, I hadn't told anybody except for, I think, maybe you, Beard, because we were just starting to say, like, okay, how would we plan for this? But Hadia and I were discussing taking the first week of October off because I've just been feeling a little run down since we've launched the new shows and stuff. It was just a really big push to get them to where they're at now. And now that we're kind of on the other end of it, I just sort of needed to go, okay, let's take a break. And so my thought was, I know you and I have talked about it before, Noah, but my thought was there is a Harvest Host in Eastern Washington. These Harvest Hosts are farms and wineries and breweries that let you bring your RV and park for free. And, well, sure shit, if there isn't a fruit farm Harvest Host on a river, the Columbia River here in Washington, where they have RV parking along the river. And I thought, you know what, I'm gonna take the RV. It's a 3.5-hour drive, so it's not like one of these long hauls to Texas.
Leave JB to the monkeys for a week.
No, I was actually planning to work there. I thought I'd go there, set up, and I would just work from the riverside for a week, and that would sort of be my recharge.
You are super ridiculous, Chris.
Why?
Because you can't just take a week off. You have to work.
Yeah, well,
yeah. Welcome to owning your own business.
Part of it is also like a life goal of mine is to get to the point where I could just pick up and produce content. I'm making shows for the internet. I should be able to make them from anywhere. And so, it's a rewarding vacation for me to be able to pull that off. It would be like boom.
The counterpoint is just do something else for a week.
Well, so now this was my plan.
I mean, we did that. We went to Montana, and you took a week or a couple days off and didn't produce any shows. So this is a different kind of vacation.
But it's kind of like the whole point is like you're saying I need to decompress. I need to take some time off, but you're not
right. Well, so what happens is I'm not good at being idle. But if I could go somewhere and have like a victory of doing a week's worth of shows from the river.
I get you. I just find
it
funny.
That would be, yeah. But that would be so uplifting for me that I would come back with a huge sense of accomplishment. And it would really, like, enthuse me to come back. So that's why, even though you're right. But see, the thing is like, you know, when I wasn't pre-producing or doing a show or post-producing the show, I'd be at a fruit vineyard and, you know, that's just, they have a cafe. It was just going to be amazing. But when this came out and Canonical's officially announced it now, the Ubuntu rally, it's just too good of an opportunity. Like, I've never met Ikey in person. I get very rare opportunities to see Popey and Wimpy in person. Not to mention the last time I saw Mark Shuttleworth was a couple of years ago. So it would just be just alone just to shake hands and talk to these people. And
yeah, it's a lot different than some of these huge like industry conventions, because you're meeting and getting personal time with these people that it's stuff that can pay off for years.
Yeah. And it's
just making friends.
And it's there's a real tangible benefit to converting online friendships into real life friendships. Putting a face, putting mannerisms and personalities to the text that you see on the screen makes it a more viable long term working relationship, and that's super valuable too. So, I think I'm going to load up in the truck. I'm good. I'm trying to talk Kadi into going with me. I'm going to get an air mattress for the bed. It's because I have a 5.5 foot bed. And I'm going to get an air mattress, a DC-powered air mattress for it. And I'm going to bring some sleeping bags. And I'm going to head to New York at the end of the month. And I'm just going to sleep in my truck. And I'm going to bring all of my photography equipment. And I'm just going to try to get the most out of it. Because the thing is the rooms in that area, the deal, like the budget rooms, do you have a guess? I mean, they're not crazy. So don't go like crazy. But do you have a guess what a budget room is?
$600-$700.
That's the medium room. The budget room is $370 a night. A night, and it's a multi-night event, and I want to get in a little early too.
Yeah, I think the rooms down in Long Beach are like $250.
Yeah, it's just, and you know, just oh my gosh, man, and hillbilly. What is it when you live on the road? Hobo. It's gonna be Hobo Chris. It's gonna be Hobo Chris going to New York.
So, there's this dude that just showed up at the studio one day. I had no idea who it was, but apparently he's Chris's new best friend.
Yeah, you're talking about Mike? Yeah, he hung out for a couple of days. So we had this barbecue for Linux Unplugged, and I can't remember, I think Michigan or something like that. He made quite the trek to get out here for the barbecue. He was the guy that won the title for the furthest commute. And we chatted. He was a listener of User, and I think he's caught up now. And also of Unfilter.
Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Mike. And we chatted a bit, had a good talk. He bought a bunch of meat from our local Savannah Meats here and then left because he didn't have time to cook it all. So we still have it in the freezer. And he took off. And then a couple of weeks later, a few weeks later, I got a message from him. And he's like, hey, are you around? I have a couple suggestions regarding JB. I mean, yeah, I work here every day. I mean, I'm pretty much here at least 6 days. Actually, 7 days a week most time. Sometimes 6 days. And I'm like, so how about Monday? And he's like, okay, I'll be there. And he shows up Monday morning, and I had a show canceled. So I was like, well, gosh, I got the whole afternoon. And we literally, I think pretty much the entire day, sat in the living room just chatting about different things and covering different topics. And through that, I'm just going to use Mike's first name here. But through that, I learned that Mike and I have a few common experiences, and that after some things in life had gone a little wrong, he decided to hit the road. And he has been living out of his car in just hitting the road, staring at different places. He spent a few months like in Texas and a few other places, and just kind of going around, and he's working on a long-term project, a pretty cool content delivery platform, amongst other things. But what struck me about it is Mike isn't the first person now. There's a collection of people that I've met. They're all around my age or maybe a little younger or older. And they're living on the road because they want to. Like, Mike saved up a good chunk of money from an IT gig that he had. Put it in savings. And then got to a point where he's like, I just want to spend a year developing this thing and traveling around. And it's worked for him. And it's worked really well. He's out traveling around right now. He spent some time in Washington, and now he's out and about. And I've met a couple of other listeners that do the same thing. And they're the most interesting people in the world. They're They're super smart, really articulate, very informed, very, very normal seeming people that have chosen to live out of their vehicles. And I think because I live out of the RV, maybe they see like commonality.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been to meet these people in person, either through meetups here at JB or when I'm traveling. And like I ran into this listener. I was at a rest stop. And I'm at a rest stop, and they're parked three vehicles over, and they recognize Lady Jupes from the vlog, and they saw us, we're sitting at the picnic table with the kids, and they come over and start talking to us, watch the shows, listen to the shows, living out of their rig. They're just traveling around. They do odd jobs. This guy, he sets up websites for businesses to the towns he travels, which is a seriously, it's a brilliant business model. So this guy,
you leave a trail of clients.
He decides, so we're going to go to this town. We'll spend a couple of weeks here. He does a little pre-sales before he gets there. He gets a couple of clients. And he goes in and sets up websites for him, does all the SEO optimization, all that crap that people buy, and then hands it off to him. And then they remain residual clients after that. And that's just what he does. He's been doing it for a couple of years. And he's got a wife with him who is a published author, which is amazing. In fact, I met another listener, listener John. Same thing. He's up in our area. He's working a job. He just got a new job. And his wife is an author. And she's working some jobs while they live out of their RV. And people are so just comfortable with themselves, comfortable about the fact that this is how they've chosen to live. It's not a compromise. It's a choice. And they're just super interesting. And so to pick their brains about stuff, they have really interesting perspectives on stuff. So anyways, going back to Mike, he and I talked, you know, extensively about some of these things that you and I just covered in the Ask Air segment. Mm-hmm. Just extensively he and I covered some of these things. And it is, I think, what people have labeled millennials as sort of these carefree people that don't want to get any work done is more and more, I think what it is people of the millennial generation have realized that it's a rigged game and a raw deal for a lot of them, not everybody.
It's these smart people that are like, you know, just because something is a societal norm doesn't mean it has to be that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all a hallucination. What we decide, the fact that we all respect the law is just a group hallucination. The authority structures and all of it. And I guess for some people, they just decide not to participate in it. And something is just, for me, there's a part of me that really respects it. And I don't know if it's for me completely, but when I see them and I talk to them, I don't see some homeless person living out of their car. I see somebody who is strong and bold and adventurous, because it's not easy to do that. And they could do other things if they chose to.
Yeah. I feel like I'm kind of starting down the road of taking back the title of Millennial Chris, where like, The people label things as millennials are ruining this, millennials are ruining that. But to me, it's like it's this group of people that have just realized that things can be different. You can do different things, and that's okay. It'll work out somehow.